Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson, and this is On Point. A victory today at the Supreme Court for the baker who refused to bake a wedding cake for a gay couple. In a 7-2 narrowly defined decision, justices upheld the baker's right to deny his services to a same-sex couple. This has been one of the most watched for rulings this season, with big implications for free speech and religious and gay rights. This hour on Point, the Supreme Court decides the cake baker case. Now what? You can join us on air or online. Did the High Court get this one right or not? You can join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook, where they're at On Point Radio. Later this hour, we'll look at RFK's legacy 50 years after the assassination. But let's get right to the big news of the day. Joining me first from New Haven, Connecticut, is Emily Bazelon, a staff writer for The New York Times Magazine, co-host of Slate's Political Gabfest, and fellow at Yale Law School. Emily, great to have you. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So this is one of the most anticipated rulings out of the Supreme Court this term. Remind us of this case. What happened here? It began in Colorado.
That's right. This is a case about a cake maker who was making wedding cakes in a store, and he refused a custom order from a same-sex couple for their wedding. He said that he had a religious objection to gay marriage, and he didn't want to bake them the cake that they wanted. The couple complained to the Colorado Civil Rights Commission. Colorado is a state that protects against discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation. And the couple won at the state level. And then the baker challenged that decision in court. And so what the reason for all the interest in this case was the pitting of one important constitutional right against another. We have the right to be free from discrimination, to go to whatever store you want and get what you want, no matter who you are, versus someone's right to not provide service because of a religious belief and objection.
Right. So there seemed to be this struggle about how to balance accommodations for the baker without violating the civil rights.
Exactly. And it mattered a great deal that Colorado was a state that protected discrimination against gay people and did not have a separate law protecting religious beliefs from any kind of incursion by the state, any kind of regulation.
How did the justices vote? What was the swing? Who was the swing vote here?
Well, it's interesting. There isn't exactly a swing vote. It's a 7-2 decision in which most of the court is in agreement on the holding. And it's quite a narrow holding that has to do with the very specific facts here. The court looked at the proceeding in front of the state Civil Rights Commission and found that a few of the commissioners made remarks that a majority of the justices believe were disparaging to the religious beliefs of the baker. They decided, and this is now, we're talking about six justices who are in agreement on this point, they're saying, well, you know, these commissioners, they don't look entirely neutral and respectful about religion. And because of that, we want to send this case back. And so, again, this is really a narrow decision. The majority opinion by Justice Kennedy says we could imagine a situation in which a state respectfully looked at a claim like this baker's and then ruled against him. But that's not what happened here. What we see here is what the court called official expressions of hostility to religion. Mm.
So the justices were weighing this clash between gay rights and religious liberty, trying to decide when, if ever, a business owner has the right to be exempted from a state's civil rights law. Is that the bottom line?
Yeah, exactly. And I think that, you know, in a sort of frustrating way for some court watchers, the big constitutional question here is really reserved for another day. And instead, what we see here is the court's sensitivity and concern about a state proceeding that would seem in some way to not be entirely respectful of religious rights. So the court's rhetoric, Justice Kennedy's rhetoric, is very much about that concern that religious people get a fair hearing. And while there's some discussion of the importance of protecting gay people against discrimination, that sort of takes a back seat in light of the facts here.
Right, because the decision did not resolve whether other opponents of same-sex marriage, including
Oh, florists or photographers or videographers, makeup artists could refuse commercial services to gay couples as well.
That's right. I mean, there is this line from Justice Kennedy that I think proponents of marriage equality and gay rights will appreciate. Justice Kennedy says, our society has come to the recognition that gay persons and gay couples cannot be treated as social outcasts or as inferior in dignity and worth. Justice Kennedy is big on dignity. And so you see that there. But that did not, in this case, translate into a right to walk into a shop and order a custom-made cake for a gay wedding.
We're going to have reaction from both sides on this ruling. Joining me from Villanova, Pennsylvania, is Michael Moreland, a professor at Villanova Law School. He supported the cake shop owner. Professor Moreland, welcome back to On Point. Nice to have you.
Hello, Jane. Glad to be here.
So you were part of an amicus brief to the Supreme Court. You supported the baker. How do you see the legal issues here and this decision?
I was on an amicus brief that made a much stronger argument on behalf of the free speech claim here on behalf of the baker. But as Emily says, the court's opinion is a good deal narrower than that. It really turns on the facts of the proceedings in the Colorado Civil Rights Commission and the evidence of religious bias that were there. And as Emily said, it puts off for another day questions about the larger rights of freedom of speech and free exercise of religion in cases like this.
What are the ramifications here, Michael, more broadly speaking? I mean, the religious bias against the baker holds more water than the discrimination of a gay couple. Is that really what it is?
Well, as Justice Kennedy says, the baker here had a right to a religiously neutral adjudication of his arguments, basically, before the Colorado Commission. And given the evidence on the record and also the differential treatment between bakers who had refused to make cakes that had anti-gay messages and how the baker in this case was treated, he said that shows a level of animosity. So it's very much, I would say, factually dependent on the precise way in which this case got adjudicated In the state courts below, in the state commission, the state courts. So I do think that in terms of larger implications, I think it's all yet to be seen.
A lot of our listeners are asking, can you understand how to many people this looks like discrimination? A cake baker will not bake a cake for a gay couple. That's discrimination. What's your response?
Well, I think that as Justice Kennedy says in his opinion, toleration is a two-way street, that on the one hand, there should be or there is constitutionally a right of same-sex marriage, and that's well established now. But on the other hand, I think there are also constitutional rights of freedom of expression and freedom of religion, and one of those aspects of freedom of religion is a right to a religiously neutral proceeding when you make arguments on behalf of your religious views, and that's what the seven justices agreed the Colorado Commission did not satisfy here.
Did you think this vote would be tighter, 7-2 vote?
I think if it had been a big opinion on freedom of speech or free exercise of religion across the board with respect to anti-discrimination law, the court obviously would have been much more narrowly divided. So, for instance, Justice Thomas has a concurring opinion in the case joined by Justice Gorsuch making the sort of big free speech argument here. But given how Justice Kennedy narrowed the opinion to these facts about the bias in the Colorado Commission, that's what I think enabled him to get Justices Kagan and Breyer on board. Because they agreed that the evidence of bias was there.
Got a lot of good callers here. Let me get Asher in first from Florence, South Carolina. Hi, Asher.
Hi, Jane. Just a quick comment. I'm a trans man, so, you know, I'm a big champion of the LGBTQ community. But, you know, I gotta say, I agree with the baker. He owns his own business. He has his own views. You know, you live in America, you do what you want. If this couple, you know, he says, hey, you know, I don't agree with what you're doing. You know, okay, fine. The couple should have taken their money elsewhere and supported maybe a queer baker who would have gladly made a great cake for their wedding. Mm. You know, let bygones be bygones.
Mm-hmm. You support the decision, Asher. Thank you very much. Alex is in New Orleans, Louisiana. Hi, Alex. You're on the air.
Hi, Jane. It's such a pleasure.
Thank
you. I kind of agree with the previous caller.
Yep.
I think they should have supported, you know, their community to help them, you know, because monetarily they could have used it, you know, keep it in the family in a sense. And, you know, respect is a two-way street. And, you know, if you're not getting respect at the counter, you know, you probably should take your dollar bill somewhere else.
Alex, thank you. Emily Bazelon, jump back in here. Justices Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Sonia Sotomayor cast the lone dissents here. Anything significant in their writing?
Well, they're having an argument with the majority about this case and then another case that the Colorado Civil Rights Commission decided, in which a different customer, totally different guy, comes in and he wanted a cake that said things like homosexuality is a detestable sin. So this is like the opposite of the gay wedding cake. This is a like anti-gay people cake. And so in that case, the Colorado Civil Rights Commission said that the customer did not have a right to that cake. And so in the majority opinion and in the concurrence, particularly Justice Kagan's concurrence, this turns into like a question of, okay, well, are these customers being treated the same or differently? Justice Kagan, and I think that Ginsburg and Sotomayor will be in agreement with her, though I'm not quite done reading their opinion, but Justice Kagan points out that there is a perfectly valid reason to treat these different cases differently, that the person who was denied the anti-gay marriage cake, anyone would have been denied a cake with that message, whereas the gay couple was denied because of their sexual orientation. She thinks that that is really important. And the reason this comes up is just this notion that this Colorado Civil Rights Commission had more than one cake with a message about homosexuality that it was deciding. And so that's part of the court's feeling here. I think that this was very early days for Colorado. Colorado hadn't even legalized gay marriage when these customers walked into this baker's store.
Well, we're discussing today's big ruling at the Supreme Court in the case of the baker who refused to make a cake for a gay couple. Emily Bazelon is my guest, staff writer for The New York Times Magazine. Michael Moreland, professor of law and religion at Villanova University. Listeners, we'd love to have you join us here. What does this case mean to you? Inclusion, free speech, religious liberty? Did the High Court get this one right or not? I'm Jane Clayson. More after this break, including your calls. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS ConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
What does it take to start something from nothing? And what does it take to actually build it? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on How I Built This, I speak with founders behind some of the most inspiring companies in the world. Find it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. We're talking this hour about the big decision just released at the Supreme Court in the case of the baker who refused to make a wedding cake for a gay couple. You can join the conversation. Where do you draw the line between religious liberty and discrimination? Are you celebrating this decision or not? Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. We're talking this hour with Emily Bazelon, staff writer at the New York Times Magazine and fellow at Yale Law School, and with Michael Moreland, professor at Villanova Law School. Joining me now from Washington is Sharon McGowan, legal director and chief strategy officer at Lambda Legal. Sharon, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Jane.
So this didn't come out the way you would have hoped. What's the message you got from the Supreme Court today?
Well, I agree with the assessment that there was a lot that, at least on paper, was left undecided, but we are very, very troubled by the way in which the Supreme Court's decision today really creates a gotcha situation for state government officials who are trying to enforce non-discrimination laws that are the key to ensuring that not only LGBT people can access public accommodations on equal footing with others, but also really sort of threat threatens to sort of put us back into what Ruth Bader Ginsburg described as skim milk marriage land, right? That you can be married, but the extent to which your marriage must be respected is going to inherently sort of turn on whether or not an individual has asserted a religious objection to having to respect that marriage. So, again, I agree that there is a lot that the court on paper left undecided, but there is a lot in here to cause tremendous concern for proponents of equality.
So this comes down to free expression for a lot of people, as you know, Sharon, that at the heart of this is a First Amendment issue. I mean, to your mind, here's the court ruling here. Where do you draw the line between religious liberty and discrimination?
Well, one of the things that's very important to emphasize is that the court left open the question that is battled out in the footnotes here about whether or not making a wedding cake is something different when it's a gay couple as opposed to a heterosexual couple. And in some ways, that's the fight that we've been having and the struggle we've been having about marriage equality since day one. The arguments to keep gay couples out of marriage equality was the suggestion that somehow it was different or other or less than when gay couples did so. So I think that when we look at how these non-discrimination laws are going to continue to be applied going forward, It is fair and appropriate for state human rights commissions to recognize that LGBT people and same-sex couples have the right to obtain the same goods and services as anyone else when you have opened yourself up for business to the general public. And we have seen time and time again, whether it's in the context of wedding-related services or healthcare services or other kinds of services that are really matters of life and death, that LGBT people get turned away because there's an argument that somehow having to provide them with the same service that they provide to heterosexual couples makes it somehow different. And we know that that's not the case, and we are going to continue to make sure that non-discrimination laws provide the same level of access to public services and to businesses that folks should be entitled to.
So, Michael Moreland, jump back in here. What about Sharon's argument that this ruling from the high court sets up a sort of gotcha situation, as she called it, for local governments trying to enforce these non-discrimination laws?
Well, but again, I think that the decision itself is quite narrow. It says that the Civil Rights Commission can't engage in bias, overt bias toward religious claimants when these cases come up. But as to the larger issues, I think, again, those have been postponed for another day. I do think that, you know, it's relevant here that a lot of states don't have protection, as Sharon knows well, for sexual orientation and gender identity discrimination. And I think part of the reason for that is a concern on behalf of a lot of voters and legislators in those states that people like Jack Phillips will be subject to being forced to participate in making things artistic expression to which they have disagreements. And so I do think that in a way, this way of mutual toleration that Justice Kennedy carves out here in the opinion is something that I think on the whole is actually quite powerful.
Emily Bazelon, how many states have these anti-discrimination laws? What's the breakdown? Do you know?
I'm not sure what the exact count is, but I think Professor Mullen's correct that a lot of states don't explicitly protect against discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation, right? So you can have an anti-discrimination law that doesn't name sexual orientation as one of the protected categories. And, you know, part of what is going on here, and Justice Kennedy makes this clear when he talks about how recently it was that Colorado legalized gay marriage, we're talking about a relatively new phenomenon. And so the accompanying phenomenon of cake bakers and wedding photographers being uncomfortable with serving gay couples is one that may just sort of ebb over time. I think that's the one undercurrent to Kennedy's opinion here. There is a counter argument, and Sharon's making it. And historically, you know, when we look at things like the rights of African Americans to be served at lunch counters in the South, we did not say that businesses could discriminate against them because of a religious belief. It was really important that those stores and businesses were open to everyone. We think of them as places of public accommodation. Mm-hmm. But I think you also hear, and this was true in some of the callers, a kind of concern about forcing someone who owns a small business to do something they don't want to do, like bake a cake. Mm-hmm. And that's the tension that is playing out in this case. And it may be that Justice Kennedy's solution allows this to just the culture and the politics of this issue to just kind of ebb over time.
And so, Michael Moreland, before we go back to calls here, to Sharon's point about, you know, wedding services, healthcare providers, and others who simply turn away LGBT people with this ruling, you know, there's the concern that that happens more often, to which you say what?
Well, again, I don't think this was a denial of service case. It was a denial of creative expression case. I am willing to agree with Sharon that where you have a public accommodation law that's applicable to gas stations and convenience stores and whatever, that in those cases, then there isn't a sort of right of freedom of expression or religious free exercise against serving LGBT customers in those cases.
A lot of listener response here. One says the policy of the baker is bad and stupid. Being bad and stupid is still constitutional. Another, Dev, says 7-2 decision is a good thing. As a private shop owner, he should have the right to serve or not to serve. We should not impose our values on everybody. That might make the society a rather totalitarian society. Here's Sue in Bethel, Maine. Hi, Sue. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
You bet.
I would just like to say, I hope the shop owner has posted his religious beliefs, because is he asking everybody that walks in everything about their life? He's discriminating unless he's asking everybody to follow the same rules he wants followed.
Sue, thank you. Sharon, to Sue's point, how do you draw the line? Does this case make that clear?
Well, I think that, you know, again, part of what's troubling here is the fact that, you know, the decision really does sort of set up a dynamic where how the commission sort of goes through this exercise of weighing its interest in enforcing non-discrimination laws is going to be fraught, because if there's a slipped word or somehow any suggestion that there is an important compelling interest in combating discrimination, that somehow it would be interpreted as being hostile to those who hold a view who don't actually believe that this is discrimination that is problematic. And just to your point earlier, you know, and Emily sort of makes, you know, the point that obviously Justice Kennedy talks about the fact that there has been evolution with respect to marriage equality, but in many ways there hasn't really been a lot of evolution in terms of the use of these kinds of arguments to deny LGBT people equal service, right? We have seen, you know, sort of different iterations of it, but the fact is, you know, for many, many decades we have seen different kinds of arguments used to try and deny LGBT people equal service. And as society has evolved, many of those arguments no longer are socially palatable, the notion that somehow we are sort of morally deviant or that our families are unworthy. And so we are now sort of seeing religion once again sort of being deployed as a way to accomplish ultimately the same goal that has been the objective of those who oppose equality from the outset, which is finding a way to basically create an exit ramp to full access to public services for LGBT people.
Michael Moreland, push back on that. What do you say?
Well, again, I think that as to general places of public accommodation, that the anti-discrimination laws in the states that have them should apply. But there are these particular contexts involving creative enterprises like bakers and photographers and the like, where I do think that the rights of freedom of expression, freedom of religion are more powerful and can be accommodated, and that in particular, to go back to the facts of the case in Colorado, that the bias that was evinced by statements of the commissioners here and the differential treatment of Jack Phillips compared to the baker who refused to make an anti-gay cake, that evinces a lack of neutrality on the part of the commission that I think was very troubling to seven members of the court.
Let me get more calls in here. Daryl in Jacksonville, Florida. Hi, Daryl. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Thank you. I was just interested to find that delightful to see a different change in the liberals as opposed to the conservatives with respect of discrimination as well. I don't have anything against anybody's sexuality, but all these laws came into effect when I was growing up, discrimination, and I was disenfranchised and also not even able to advance because I had to give in to the minorities, and I said, with all due respect, I respect the law.
So what do you make of this case, Daryl? What do you make of this decision at the High Court?
I think it's time for the changes there. In other words, it's establishing the fact, hey, the guy, he could go get a cake anywhere, but he wanted to make an issue about a cake. I mean, this is really far-fetched, but it went to what the judges saw as well. Take it back down there to it's Colorado's problem. Mm-hmm. it's, you got all these minorities trying to dominate the media scene, and all of a sudden you get a burp, not one of your got yous, and then all of a sudden, oh, with discrimination during busing, I had to go to a black school. I had no problem with that. But it took a while for the blacks to get up into society and to make their claim. Now you have the LGBTs trying to escalate off that ladder. You know, I need my equality, but they're infringing on everybody else's liberties.
Daryl, thank you very much. Let's get Gio in here from Hollywood, Florida. Hi, Gio. What do you think on this?
Hi, Jane. Hi. I think it's really sad. It's just disheartening to see that we're taking such a big step backwards. It's a slippery slope. I mean, today's a cake. Tomorrow, it's going to be a doctor in an ER refusing to take care of an LGBT person who could be dying.
Gee, I don't think that's what this case says. Emily Bazelon, that would not be appropriate, would it be?
No, I hope not. But I think the kind of pain in your caller's voice speaks to the sensitivity gay people have to how they've been treated in the past. And Sharon talked about this, too. And there's a lot of legitimate fear and concern that we could slip back into being a society in which gay couples do face a number of barriers that really deeply affect their lives, go way beyond where you buy your wedding cake. And the court didn't clearly say no to that today. So people who wanted a clean rule that said gay people have the right to buy, to get services for their weddings wherever they want, that didn't happen. And to, you know, the gay rights community, that's a big disappointment.
Sharon McGowan, jump back in here. What did you hear in our caller Gio's voice in his point there?
No, I think it was really important, and I'm glad that Gio was able to get through today, because the brief that Lambda Legal filed in this case, a friend of the court brief in support of the couple, really brings to the fore the fact that part of what we are talking about here is the ability of LGBT people to walk into a store and know that they are not going to be turned away because of who they are. And I know that there's been a lot of an attempt to talk about the fact that it is limited to sort of the, you know, the fact that it's a particular cake, but again, that turns on this notion that a gay couple coming in to buy a wedding cake, you know, somehow is asking for something different than a heterosexual couple buying a wedding cake. And in the context of other places that we've seen, you know, whether it's an Uber driver kicking out a couple because he doesn't want them holding hands and leaving them on the side of the road, or daycare turning away, you know, a young child because they have two mothers. I mean, I think that part of what the grave concern is here is that without sort of a full, robust ability to enforce non-discrimination laws, LGBT people and many others who have always historically had to fear discrimination, it's not just when I walk into the bakery, it's when I walk into any business. Because I think in some ways the caller talking about sort of the small business owner, I think any small business owner feels as though they are engaged in some level of creative task and the reason they go into the business in the first place. And so if that becomes the test for whether or not an individual proprietor has to serve equally all people in society, then you wind up in a world where every time a gay person opens the door and the bell rings on a small business, they have to figure out whether or not today is the day that they are going to be rejected because of who they are.
Let's get Doug in here from St. Croix in the Virgin Islands. Hi, Doug. Thanks for waiting. You're on the air. Hi.
Hi, Jane. Real quick, this kind of is a perplexing conversation with me, because if you get a mixed couple that go in, a white and a black person, can you discriminate against me and not make my cake because you don't like the fact I'm married to a white woman or an Asian or a black to me, or you don't want to put the Star of David on a Jewish cake? I believe this opens the door eventually like a Pandora's box, and it's just you have a right to discriminate who you want to discriminate against now.
Yeah, Doug, thank you. Michael Moreland, you know, what about that? You hear Doug and many of our listeners say, you know, for people who may not understand the law completely but take an opportunity to discriminate, does this, does this case give them the opportunity to do that?
Well, I don't think so. And I think there's a danger here, an hour and 10 minutes after the decision was handed down, of overreacting. And I think both conservatives and progressives are probably liable to this. Both, you know, conservatives on the side of saying this is somehow a, you know, pushback against rights of same-sex couples and the LGBT community. And on the other hand, of progressives of saying this is the end of the civil rights movement as we know it. And I think that, again, the decision itself is very fact-bound about the proceedings in the Colorado Civil Rights Commission. As I said, a lot of states don't even have protection for LGBT customers, and I think part of the dynamic there is the concern about accommodating religious objections. But again, I do think that I want to push back against kind of overreacting on this, which I think maybe is a temptation that we're all prone to, because in the end, the decision today was actually quite narrow and factually specific.
So, Emily Bazelon, we've got about a minute left here. Very narrow, this decision, to Michael Moreland's point. This was more about baking cakes for the justices. What are the broader implications, though narrow this case may be?
Well, we have questions as a country about whether we are going to fully incorporate gay marriage and gay citizens, and whether we're going to tell people who are hesitant about that, that it's time to move along, that these are constitutional rights. And, you know, one of your callers referred to the problem of race discrimination. It's obvious, I think, to almost everyone in the country that it is not okay for a store owner to discriminate against people on the basis of race. And what we don't quite see here is precisely the same acknowledgement for gay couples. And, you know, the question is whether we're going to move down that road step by step.
More analysis to come. Big decision at the High Court today. And thanks to our panel for unpacking it for us. Emily Bazelon, staff writer for The New York Times Magazine, co-host of Slate's Political Gabfest, fellow at Yale Law School. Emily, thanks.
Thanks for having me.
Michael Moreland at Villanova Law School. Michael, thank you very much.
Thank you, Jane.
And Sharon McGowan at Lambda Legal. Sharon, thank you very much.
Thank you, Jane.
After the break, we'll switch gears and speak about the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy 50 years ago and his legacy now. You can join the conversation on that. Do you remember that fateful day 50 years ago? What did we lose? What have we kept with his legacy? I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Ever get to Friday, look back on the week, and say to yourself, what just happened? I'm Sam Sanders. Check out my podcast, It's Been a Minute, where every Friday we catch up on the news and the culture of the week and try to make sense of it all. Listen on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. 50 years ago tomorrow, the news cameras were rolling. The reporters were doing their stand-uppers at raucous crowds in L.A.'s Ambassador Hotel, celebrating Robert F. Kennedy's big primary win in his race for the Democratic nomination for president. And then this.
Senator Kennedy has been shot. Is that possible?
No!
Is that possible?
It could be.
Is it possible, ladies and gentlemen? It is possible. He has. Not only Senator Kennedy. Oh, my God. Senator Kennedy has been shot.
America was not in a good place in 1968. Vietnam and the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. happened just months before. But a lot of people dared believe that Robert Kennedy, Bobby Kennedy, had a magic touch, that he could bring the country together and help America be its best self at home and abroad. Joining me from Washington to talk about all this is Richard Kahlenberg, senior fellow at the Century Foundation. His recent essay is called The Inclusive Populism of Robert F. Kennedy, and you could find a link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Richard, welcome.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for being here. Remind us what was happening in the summer of 1968. Set the stage as we look back on the anniversary of Robert F. Kennedy's assassination.
Well, 1968, of course, was an incredibly tumultuous year. We saw the assassination of Dr. King in April. Lyndon Johnson withdrew his candidacy for the Democratic nomination for president about a week earlier. And we had some exciting candidates running for president. Eugene McCarthy was running as a peace candidate, opposed to the Vietnam War. And then we saw the entry of Robert Kennedy, the brother of a slain president, who began the campaign in Indiana and tried to do something which very few progressives have done since then. He tried to pull together a political coalition of African Americans, Latinos, who strongly believed in his powerful message about civil rights, but also to appeal to white working class voters, many of whom had voted for the segregationist George Wallace in a previous election. And the remarkable thing, the part of the reason that we're still talking about Robert Kennedy's campaign 50 years later is that he appeared to pull this off. He was able to unite the country around a shared vision, what I've called a liberalism without elitism, and a populism without racism.
So he had this incredible appeal, this cross-cutting appeal among Black, Latino, working class, white constituencies at this time of great tension in our country. And then June 5th, 1968, the night of the California primary, the last of the Democratic primary season. Richard, what happened?
Well, Kennedy was tragically assassinated by Saran Saran, and we saw the wings of the coalition that he was trying to bring together split further apart, with working class whites moving towards Richard Nixon and George Wallace, who was also running that year. Chaos at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago, and really the effort to construct what might be called a tough liberalism saw its demise with the death of Robert Kennedy.
I wanted to play this clip because it's so moving. This was on NPR's StoryCorps just last week. Juan Romero recounted cradling Robert F. Kennedy's head after he was shot that night on the floor of the Ambassador Hotel's kitchen. Romero was 17 and working as a busboy at the time.
I kneeled onto him and put my hand between the cold concrete and his head just to make him comfortable. I could see his lips moving, so I put my ear next to his lips and I heard him say, "Is everybody okay?" I said, "Yes, everybody's okay." I could feel a steady stream of blood coming through my fingers. I had a rosary in my shirt pocket, and I took it out, thinking that he would need it a lot more than me.
Richard Kahlenberg, it's hard to describe that moment in this country, how this country sort of came together. You talk about the coalitions before he was assassinated, but how this country came together in a collective moment of grief on the heels of Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination just a few months before. There was real fear in this country. Is our country safe? Is our democracy safe?
Well, that's right. And one of the remarkable moments in American political history was occurred right after Robert Kennedy was assassinated. He was flown from Los Angeles to New York for his funeral service, and then took a train ride. His body took a train ride from New York to Washington, D.C. to be buried at Arlington Cemetery. And people have remarked that if you were going to have a tribute to Robert Kennedy, it was there along the train tracks, because poor and working class people are those in this country who live near train tracks. And they lined up, African American, Latino, white working class families to pay tribute to their fallen hero. And we really haven't had a political figure who's been able to bring those groups together, groups that are hurting, all of them, and yet are divided by politics since those days.
We have that clip here, the train tracks, that moment. So many people watching Senator Kennedy's body. This is from the Netflix documentary Bobby Kennedy for President. Kennedy campaign worker Michael Dvorkin describes what it was like on the train when Bobby Kennedy's casket from New York to Arlington Seminary, a cemetery in Washington, came by.
People were on the train tracks, hanging from the rafters. Nobody had any clue what kind of reaction there was going to be. People inside the train were also overwhelmed by the response of average people.
Richard, take us back to a young Robert Kennedy. We have this image of Bobby Kennedy, the shaggy hair, the skinny ties, the shirt sleeves rolled up. That early RFK, what was he like and how did he evolve over time to the person he became, who was able to generate this incredible support among really a wide population of people?
Right. Well, he was, as a Kennedy, born to great wealth and went, like his brother John, to Harvard University. But at the same time, he was described as kind of the scrawny one of the Klan, and had that that desire to fight against the establishment. And so early in his career, he worked for the Senate in investigations of communists and of racketeering among the labor movement. He then became campaign manager for his brother John Kennedy, where he gained a reputation really for ruthlessness. He was the one who had to deliver the bad news to people who were disappointed. And so he acquired a reputation for toughness, but not necessarily in a positive sense. A lot of people didn't like the young Bobby Kennedy. Then when his brother John was elected president, Robert Kennedy became a very young attorney general of this nation and really started to find his voice and fought for civil rights, for integration, standing up for the Black liberation movement. And then people often point to the assassination of his brother in 1963 as a real turning point where he saw in a very real way the pain that people can feel in life and translated that into a passion for addressing some of the great ills in our society, poverty and racial discrimination and senseless wars. And so he managed to transform himself from a sort of a centrist or even conservative Democrat into a tribune for the underprivileged.
Here's archival footage included in the new Netflix documentary, Bobby Kennedy for President, where RFK talks with white voters about the increasing turmoil in the country in 1968.
This rioting, it seems like there's no law and order anymore. The cops have to stand around and watch all this looting going on.
We're going to have to have law and order in the United States. That's what we have to establish, that we won't tolerate lawlessness, violence, and disorder.
I mean, we've got to get this stopped. It's going to get out of hand completely.
I agree. I think that we just have to make sure that people have jobs.
It's so interesting to hear his voice. And here he is in April 1968, Robert F. Kennedy. He was met with boos at Indiana University when he called for an end to educational draft deferments during the Vietnam War.
Shall I tell you why I think that we shouldn't have student deferments? Because I think that first, no matter what one feels personally about this conflict, the fact is that the war, the burden of this war, has been borne chiefly and primarily by the poor of the United States.
Richard Kahlenberg, he raised deep moral issues surrounding the Vietnam War, but he threaded the needle very carefully on this issue.
Absolutely. And that was his brilliance as a moral leader and also as a politician. So lots of liberal candidates had talked in the past about the common interests that working class white and Black people have around those economic issues. But Kennedy saw it was important to respect the values of working class people as well as their interests. And so in your clips, I think that's vividly demonstrated. He was for law and order at the same time as he was for fighting racial injustice. On national security issues, he thought the Vietnam War was going in the wrong direction. But at the same time, he recoiled at kind of the liberal elitism on campus where privileged white students were
draft
getting,
dodging. Yeah,
yeah, were they were doing it legally. Mm-hmm. That was the problem is that they could get that deferment, and so he saw both sides of that, and I think that's why voters of very, very different backgrounds, you know, African American voters on the one hand, former George Wallace voters on the other, saw something appealing in him.
A lot of calls here, like Mike first from Richmond, Virginia. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I'm just calling to say that I remember when Robert Kennedy was shot. I was 13 years old. My dad was in the military. His brother, John, had just been shot while we were in Germany. Then we returned back to the United States, and Martin Luther King was shot while we were in Fort Benning, Georgia. And then just Dad had been he was reassigned, and when Robert Kennedy was shot. Mm.
And what do you remember feeling in that moment, Mike?
I remember a profound sense of hopelessness. First John F. Kennedy, then Martin Luther King, then Robert F. Kennedy. Everyone who was concerned about fairness seemed to be dead. Mm. And it's not that much unlike, it's very similar to right now. In a weird sort of way. Except
we'll get to those lessons in just a minute. And I do appreciate you calling, Mike. My time is short, and I want to get Tom in here from Manchester, Connecticut. Hi, Tom. Welcome to the program.
Hello, Jane. I'm African-American, and I was about 11 and a half years old when it happened and felt a profound loss because he seemed like he had soothing words after Dr. King's assassination. He seemed to be the right candidate, you know, before his death by Sirhan, that unfortunately, I guess, picked him up out of anger, what happened to the Palestinian people after the Six-Day War. But I'm glad, I guess, that Rosie Grier, a former football player, stepped in and grabbed the gun away from him. And it was never the same because of Nixon coming in on the law and order, and he became an anti-black bigot along the way before the Whitewater. Mm-hmm. But I think it was profound. Lost. It's never been the same again.
Never same again. Tom, I'm so sorry to cut you off, but my time is so short. And Richard, I mean, it's hard to know. Do you ever think he could have beat Nixon, RFK?
Well, I mean, there are a lot of people who have played this out, the what-ifs. But certainly we saw that he could, that Robert Kennedy could have appealed to a lot of the voters that Nixon ended up getting. Nixon was struck when watching Robert Kennedy campaign and remarked to a reporter, people think that Bobby Kennedy is more law and order than I am. Well, that was part of Nixon's kind of insidious appeal. He didn't balance the call for order with a call for fairness and civil rights, and Robert Kennedy was able to do that. Mm-hmm. And so we would have had a very, very different country if Robert Kennedy had been president instead of Richard Nixon.
RFK, many people say, well, he's been romanticized a bit. He certainly had some rough edges. But to Mike's point, the caller, does Robert Kennedy's campaign, his life, the way he brought coalitions together, does it have any relevance 50 years later in the age of in our political age today?
Well, I think part of the reason we're talking so much about Robert Kennedy is not just the 50th anniversary of his campaign and his assassination, but also because of the 2016 election. I mean, it was astounding. We had Donald Trump, a conservative, winning 22% of former Obama white working class voters. And Bobby Kennedy had done the exact opposite. Mm. He had brought over the Wallace voters, and so it's really a moment when we have to think about the possibilities and the lessons for today.
Richard Collenberg, senior fellow at the Century Foundation, and 50 years after the assassination of RFK, looking at the lessons from that time. Thank you, Richard, very much.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Jane. Appreciate it.
Continue the conversation, listeners. We're at onpointradio.org on Twitter and Facebook. Thank you so much for your calls. Big Hour. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point.